The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Microsun Lamps.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program and to the air studio Timothy Gaffney, the author of Dayton Beer, A History of Brewing in the Miami Valley. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Tim, what inspired you to write about Dayton beer, of all things? Has anyone ever done this before? Wasn't there another book about Dayton beer?
There have been a couple of books about local brewing history, but they were pretty anecdotal, and I wanted to do something that was a little more well-documented. I really wanted to get to the basics, of the, you know, get to the bottom of the stories and find out what the narrative was, not just who had what brewery when, but how did it all fit together over, you know, the course of a couple of centuries here in Dayton.
How did you go about the project? How did you approach it?
Well, it's a funny thing because one of the reasons I wrote it was I thought this will be a quick, easy book. It'll be fun. It'll be light reading. And when I started getting into it and I started discovering how little we really knew about these brewers and how little real information was out there, I just became somewhat obsessed with digging into the records and finding out the facts about the brewers and the breweries.
You went back to the beginning and discovered that the history of the early brewing locations around Dayton was very fascinating and also an amazingly prolific group of people. And they were mostly Germans, weren't they?
In the beginning, the first brewers in the early 1800s were mostly English and Irish, but from about 1830s on, it pretty much became all German brewers.
And initially, those beers would have been kind of sour and unpleasant, I would think.
As far as I can tell, the early beers all tended to be pretty sour. I found an 1880 book which took a look at the national brewing scene, and the author of that said that just until a few years earlier, beers typically were not very good and were apt to be sour. That's, as I understand it, that was the case here in Dayton. The thing that really changed beer, as far as I can tell, was the advent of lager beer. And here in Dayton, that was in the 1850s. And when I say Dayton, I'm speaking largely of the Miami Valley.
And this was a process developed in Germany. Explain the difference between lagering and the swill that they were drinking before that.
Well, it wasn't all necessarily swill, I guess. But ales, it all comes down to the yeast. There are different varieties of yeast. But ales are basically brewed with the yeast that forms on top of the beer. And it ferments pretty much at room temperature. Lager is a kind of yeast that ferments from the bottom, and it requires cold temperatures, but the result is a clearer, crisper beer. And it was lager beer that really swept the country around the middle of the 1800s.
And I'm sure it was delicious in comparison to some of the earlier beers. And a lot of these brewers had side businesses, didn't they? A lot of them were in the ice business, because that was an important part of making lager in the summer. Wouldn't they go to ponds and lakes and cut ice and then store it so they could make the beer?
That was a big part of the business in the 1800s, early to mid-1800s. Breweries often had a big pond nearby, and sometimes they would make arrangements with farmers to have a field that they could flood during the winter, harvest the ice off that, and then they would use that to fill up their lagering cellars during the summer to keep the beer cold. But they would also sell ice on the side. And when mechanical refrigeration came along in the late 1800s. That became a big adjunct to their business.
Mm. My guest is Tim Gaffney. His book is Dayton Beer, A History of Brewing in the Miami Valley. And you have so many photos, great photos. And it was really interesting to see how many of these buildings no longer exist. And then some of them that actually are still around. I was pleasantly surprised to see that the Dayton Metro Library is got an administrative office in a former brewery.
That's right. That's the old Saxe Pruden Brewery. And it was originally right along the Miami and Erie Canal.
Uh-huh.
But it's over close to the main library. And that was, as many people know, that was Howard's Music for many years. They helped to preserve that building. And then in more recent years, Dayton Metro Library, when they were going through all their remodeling, bought that building and used it as its administrative offices. But they've preserved a lot of the original structure. So inside that building, you can see a lot of the original brick and timber. And it's personally interesting to me because my wife was a career librarian for Dayton Metro Library, and her last years with the system there before she retired was up on the fourth floor of that building. Huh. So here I am writing a book about a brewery, and there she is working in an old brewery.
Well, it's a nifty photo, the one that shows these two buildings, the Howard's, former Howard's building on the one side, and then you have the canal going right between these two buildings, and you picture that now and you just go, whoa. Tell us about the importance of canals in the story of early brewing.
The canal, the Miami-Erie Canal, is really a big part of Ohio history. Everybody who lives in the Miami Valley should know about the Miami and Erie Canal. It was the superhighway of the early to mid-19th century. And, of course, it was replaced, you know, by railroads. But it was an important artery. It was built in the early 1800s as a way for farmers in Ohio to get their products out of the interior of the state down to the Ohio River, down to Cincinnati, down to New Orleans. And it was also a major path of immigration for the brewers. And they would come up the river from Cincinnati. Many of them came into the United States, came to over the Rhine, and then came up the river, up through the Miami Valley. And they tended to follow the canal. The canal, of course, was a source of ice for them, but it was also a big source of transportation for their goods and for their own travel until the railroads came along closer to the middle of the century.
Tim, you just mentioned over the Rhine, which most of our listeners are probably familiar with, the area in Cincinnati that was a magnet for German immigrants back in the day. And Cincinnati, we think of all the beer that came out of Dayton. Cincinnati was a mammoth beer brewing city, wasn't it?
Oh, Cincinnati was huge. It was huge even on the national level. And one reason why I limited my book not to include Cincinnati is because it has books of its own.
Uh-huh.
And was beyond the scope of what I could do. But I tended to think of Over the Rhine as the launch pad for the Miami Valley's brewers. It was a place where German immigrants would come in, they would settle there for a short time, and then move up the valley. And many of the brewers that I found here in Dayton and even up to Minster would start out down at Over the Rhine, and they would either learn or sharpen their brewing skills there before moving up the valley and starting their own breweries.
Tell us about some of these early brewers. Who were they? What kind of operations were they running? Tell us how they made the beer and just what they were like. These guys did well, didn't they? Some of them built beautiful homes and were really movers and shakers in the community, weren't they?
Some of them did, and some of the homes are still standing even when the breweries aren't. And I don't want to just focus simply on Dayton, even though the title is Dayton Beer. I looked at breweries in a number of communities. One of the places was in Sydney, Ohio,
mm-hmm.
where the Wagner family had a brewery. If you're up in years like me and you have a skillet at home, you might turn it over, and on the bottom you might see Wagnerware on it. And that was a big kitchenware company formed by the Wagners up in Sydney. But before they were making Wagnerware, there was a branch of the Wagner family that became the town's brewers. And Wagner had a very beautiful Victorian house just up the street from his brewery. The brewery is all gone except for one building, but the house is still standing and it's still well preserved.
It's true. You talk about brewing in Piqua and Troy and Xenia. All these towns had breweries. In fact, didn't Xenia have one of the first breweries in this area?
As far as I can tell from the records I searched, Xenia had perhaps the earliest brewery. I think they had one as early as 1805.
Wow.
Dayton had one around 1809 or 1810. George Newcomb was one of the people who originally settled Dayton, and he was famous for Newcomb's Tavern. Well, that was more of a hotel and guest lodge, but around 1810, he added on a brewery to it. And even up in Piqua, I found mentions of a brewery up there along the river around 1807, 1810.
In case you're just tuning in, my guest is Timothy Gaffney. His book is Dayton Beer, A History of Brewing in the Miami Valley. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958. And we're going to continue with our conversation about beer right after this. It's the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, joined in studio today by Tim Gaffney. His book is Dayton Beer, A History of Brewing in the Miami Valley. A number of years ago, I had some guests who came on the program, and they had a book about wine. And I was amazed and surprised when they pulled open these bags and started pulling out bottles of wine and pulling corks on them and filling glasses with them, and we had a tasting right in the studio. So where's your bag, Tim?
I was just going to say, are you asking me where's my beer?
Yeah, where's the beer that you're going to bring us to sample today on the program?
I will have to give you a rain check for that.
Okay, all right. Speaking of which, I see you have a beer tour, a book tour, and it's called History and a Pint. And this sounds like fun. What are you up to with this?
Well, I just figured I would like to give book talks about my book. I'd like to do book signings. And I thought, you know, if you're gonna give a book talk about beer, shouldn't you do it over a beer? So what I did was I put together a little tour here, but all of the locations are brew pubs or tap houses. So you can come and learn a little bit about our history and have a beer. And if you don't like the book, at least you've had a beer.
Well, we're going to get to the renaissance in beer brewing in our region here a little bit later in the interview. And we can mention some of these appearances that you're going to be making at some of these local brewers. But first, we need to talk about the early brewing some more, and also what destroyed the brewing industry, because that's a really big part of the story, and one that I am particularly fascinated by, and that is Prohibition.
It is a fascinating history, because when you look at Dayton and the way the breweries there were proliferating from around 1810 right up to the 18th Amendment, which was the amendment that made Prohibition law. Dayton couldn't seem to get enough beer, and the breweries just kept multiplying and they kept growing. So it was a really robust industry in town. And but at the same time, brewing was becoming more popular, and lager beer was sweeping the country. There was also a movement against alcohol, and it was known in earlier years as the temperance movement, and then became known more as the prohibition movement. But it was, I think, caused quite a bit by the unruliness in saloons, as they were called then, and the proliferation really more of hard liquor than beer. I think that was behind a lot of the trouble. But the brewers offered their beer really as an alternative to whiskey. You know, lager beer was about 4% alcohol, and they tried to promote it as the healthy alternative. But the prohibition movement just gained ground, especially in the early 20th century. And really, Ohio introduced prohibition before it became national law. Ohio had its own constitutional amendment, and prohibition in Ohio actually became effective in May 1919, whereas it didn't become effective until 1920 across the country.
But it didn't happen right away, because in November of 1917, they had an election in Ohio where it lost. Prohibition lost. Remember?
It didn't happen right away. Oh, no.
It was a close vote, right?
Right.
Yeah.
It was a close vote. And there were a series of laws and votes as Ohio moved toward prohibition. And I think what was happening is the politicians were trying to have it both ways. Uh-huh. They were trying to show that they were for prohibition, but at the same time, they were trying not to throttle the alcohol beverage industry too much. But over the years, it just got gradually more restrictive. A big one in Ohio was in 1908, when there was a law passed called the Rose Law, and that was for a name for the legislature by that name. And that law allowed counties to vote themselves wet or dry.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, it was done more at the village or township level, and it allowed more urban populations to control the vote. But the countywide votes allowed more rural populations to have more influence. And so when the Rose Law was passed in 1908, more than half of Ohio counties voted themselves dry. And that was a huge blow, not so much in the urban areas like in Dayton and Springfield, but in the smaller villages, it shut down a lot of those breweries.
Montgomery County stayed wet, and you have some fascinating information in here about this one brewer, Adam, was it Shantz?
Shantz, yes.
Sounded like a really smart guy. I think you have a statistic in there that showed that there was a tavern for every 12 people in the population. That's how many taverns there were. And this Shantz guy started buying and shutting down the really notoriously unruly taverns. They were also consolidating the brewing. The companies were merging. And he seemed to be a little bit ahead of the prohibition thing. He seemed to have it kind of under control.
Well, Adam Shantz is a legendary name in Oakwood, Ohio, and in the Dayton area. There were two. There was Adam Sr. and Adam Jr., and they both were very wealthy and did a lot to develop Oakwood. There's a Shantz Avenue there in Oakwood. Shantz Sr. originally made his fortune in the meat business and then later took up brewing with his brothers. But he made his real fortune in things like real estate. Adam Shantz Jr. continued in his footsteps, and in 1904 was when they got all the brewing companies in Dayton, all the big brewing companies, and they just merged them all into what was called a combine, uh-huh. the one big incorporated brewing company. But he was trying to stay ahead of two things. One was the prohibition movement, and the other was the rise of the big national brands like Budweiser and Schlitz. And they were encroaching on the local markets, and that was something that Shantz was very much alarmed about. Now, there was, you know, it was popular back at that time to form monopolies. And so it's easy to look at what was going on in Dayton as a monopoly where all these companies formed into one combine. And then they also owned most of the saloons in town as well. But I like to think of it as circling the beer wagons against the outside threat of these national brands coming in. But yeah, that was one thing that he did. They took all these saloons, and he owned most of them, not only in Dayton, but also in surrounding towns. And they closed down the ones that were most troublesome. They were really trying to tamp down the bad behavior that was fueling the Prohibition movement.
You have a photo in your book, and I don't think that you have the location, but apparently Schlitz was opening up these fancy drinking emporiums in various cities, and you have this one strange photo in there of like the Schlitz. They have like palm trees, and not in the photo, but supposedly these places did. And the one in Dayton didn't stay open for very long.
Schlitz had a big hotel up in Milwaukee, and they had something up there called the Palm Garden. And I think it was in the spirit of the German beer gardens, which were, you know, places of socialization. And it was really an opulent place with huge palm trees and lots of light and tables. It's very fancy. So there was an attempt to make one down in Dayton.
Uh-huh.
Apparently this was a Schlitz representative, as far as I could tell and trace him. And they opened something in downtown Dayton called the Schlitz Palm Garden down here, and the address escapes me. It was right downtown, but it was supposed to be the place to go in Dayton, and it was you know, it was extremely opulent, and they had vaudeville acts up on the upper floor. Now, as far as I can tell, this only lasted about a year, and I couldn't find any pictures of the Dayton version of this Palm Garden. The only thing I found in the Library of Congress, of all places, was a picture of a saloon that was associated with it. And, of course, it's an old picture. It's black and white, but it looks like a pretty drab place to me.
Okay, let's talk about Prohibition. I'm fascinated by Prohibition, so I have brought a couple of items from my own Prohibition collection here. And these are shot glasses. One has a picture of a lady with a hatchet, and it says, "The saloons must go. Vote dry, November 6, 1917. The other one says, "Goodbye, Mr. Booze." And it's got a picture of the lady with the axe. And it says, "Vote dry, November 6, 1917. And it shows a bottle of rum with a hatchet stuck in it. And these are from Iowa. And that is the same date that they had the vote in Ohio. And in Iowa, the vote was so close, out of 430,000 votes cast, Prohibition lost by 932 votes. Very close. But like in Ohio, it was passed before it was passed nationally.
Right. Well, the person you're referring to on that glass was Carrie Nation. And she was something of a celebrity in her time. And she was known for wielding a hatchet, going into saloons, and just chopping up their bottles and barrels.
And she was a big person.
She was a big person.
Yeah.
She was about 6 feet tall.
And she come in with that axe, and it was a little axe.
Right. Yeah, it was a hatchet. It wasn't a big axe.
And some of these places, in their attempts to resist, apparently groups of women would go into the taverns and make a big scene about, you need to stop selling this horrible stuff. And the tavern keepers sometimes would respond by giving out free drinks to all the men. And so you would have all these drunken men staggering all over the place, and then these women going into these bars going, "You've got to stop this." It must have been quite a scene.
It must have, and especially in Ohio. Back in the 1870s, there was the what was called the Women's Temperance Movement, and it was really the beginning of the Women's Christian Temperance Union. But there was a campaign in 1874, and groups of women organized, and they would go and stand in front of the saloons, and they would go into the saloons if they could get in, and they would sing hymns and pray. And it had to have been quite a spectacle. In smaller towns, they had quite a bit of success. A lot of the saloons closed, and of course they claimed victory, but I suspect that in due time, a lot of those saloons reopened again. But it was quite a scene in Xenia. One place was where they had one of these marches, and the women were keeping vigil over one saloon in particular, and the name of the street escapes me now, but it was right downtown, and it was known as the Shades of Death.
Oh, yeah, right.
And
that was actually the name of the bar.
Yeah.
Yeah, right, yeah. The Shades of Death. I like that.
And the proprietor apparently held out for a number of weeks, and then finally surrendered and took out all of his booze and dumped it all out in the street. But that was quite a period of time then, and it was really, I think, a time when the movement matured and people started taking it more seriously.
Okay, so Prohibition passed very quickly. They had 7 years to have 36 states ratify it, and it took just over a year to get that number. And suddenly we had all these breweries in Dayton that had to find something else to do with their space or go out of business. They had to start brewing non-alcoholic beer or soda pop or go totally into the ice business. You even have one brewery you talk about where during the week they would be good and they would behave and they would make things that weren't illegal. And then on the weekends, they apparently were brewing beer.
I suspect that was pretty common. But the one example on record that I found was the Home City Brewing Company over in Springfield.
Uh-huh.
And they were brewing into the 1920s. And then one day there was a federal agents raided the place, and it turned out that they had thousands of gallons of beer in there that they had been using to supply speakeasies as far down as Cincinnati. So there was still a lot of brewing going on.
And you also describe how when these federal agents were disposing of this illicit liquid, that men and boys would gather and they'd be drinking it right out of the river and drinking it right out of wherever it was they were spilling it.
Well, there were a couple of different cases. Now, the one I just mentioned in Springfield, that was after national prohibition. That was in the 1920s. But the Rose Law in 1908 had a severe impact on breweries, especially in smaller communities where they were more likely to vote the county dry. So in Troy, Troy Brewery there, the Haney Brewery. I'm trying to remember exactly when that was, but shortly after the Rose Law went into effect, apparently they just opened the drain valves on their tanks and started draining all the beer out of the tanks and down the sewer into the canal. And there was a story in the Dayton Daily News that said their men and boys were running to grab any kind of a bottle or can they could and drink this stuff.
There it flows. My guest is Timothy Gaffney. We're talking about his book, Dayton Beer, A History of Brewing in the Miami Valley. And after Prohibition, it was almost a century, wasn't it, before another brewery opened in Dayton after it all went south? And in the end of your book, you talk about the renaissance in brewing and all these wonderful little breweries that have been popping up, hundreds of them in Ohio. And I can't wait to talk to you about that, but we're going to take a little break first. Is that okay with you, Tim?
That's great.
Now, where's this beer you brought us?
I'll go look for it.
Oh, okay. You're listening to WYSO. It's the Book Nook, and we'll continue right after I pop a top. It's the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to be joined in studio today by Timothy R. Gaffney, the author of Dayton Beer, A History of Brewing in the Miami Valley. Things are really getting frothy and bubbly in the brewing business in this sector in this last 10-year period, haven't they, around here?
It's been phenomenal, and it's been amazing at the persistence of these breweries, the success they've had, and the fact that they've stayed open. You know, I think everyone probably expected to see a whole lot of breweries open and then a whole bunch of them close again, which is really kind of typical in the restaurant and entertainment business. So this has been very interesting. But it really in a lot of ways, reflects the way the region looked before Prohibition.
Well, I see your point about how it's amazing that all these breweries are opening and staying open, but there was at least one brewery I can think of that was a little bit too far ahead of the curve, and that's the Miami Trail in Xenia. Now, what happened with them?
That's a brewery that I wasn't familiar with at the time it was here, but I think it was just part of its time and couldn't compete against the national brands that were out there in all the stores.
Their pale ale was decent.
I never had one.
And being right here in Yellow Springs, 10 miles from Xenia with the Miami Trail going right through town, everybody wanted that beer. I was surprised when they folded.
They, I think, inspired the people who came later. It's a brewery that was mentioned to me a number of times when I talked to different brewers around the area. So they were ahead of their time, but I think that they were probably the harbinger of things to come.
All right, it's time to publicize Tim's appearances. And first of all, he's got one Wednesday, August 7th at 5 p.m. at the Warped Wing Brewing Company at 26 Wyandotte Street in Dayton. Tell us about Warped Wing. That's another one of our big micros.
Warped Wing was really one of the things that got me into this book. Warped Wing is part of the new wave of craft breweries. It's right there on Wyandotte Street. It's just a very short distance from the old Saxe Pruden Brewing, and it's really in ground zero of the old brewing district in Dayton. But the name Warped Wing takes its name from the Wright brothers, who developed the wing warping or wing twisting method of controlling an airplane. And my background has been in aviation history and aviation heritage, so that caught my attention, and I began noticing that breweries coming along, like Warped Wing and Lock 27, they were using local history as a way of branding their companies and their products. And it just intrigued me. And what I found out as I researched the book and talked to these different brewers, it's really part of the larger movement of local. People want things that are made locally, cooked, you know, food that's grown locally. It's all a part of that. I think the history is another way that they're able to attach themselves to the local communities.
I like the fact that they're using local products to make some of these beers at some of these breweries. In fact, Warped Wing is the brewery that has a seasonal that comes out in the fall that is made with Esther Price chocolates, and every year it's a slightly different recipe.
Right, Esther's Little Secret.
Yeah.
And there's a number of breweries here that offer at least some of their brews being all locally sourced. And that's popular, I think, you know, in general among a lot of these craft brewers. And one of the things that's happened as a result is it's causing a revival in the farms around Ohio. Mm-hmm. They're starting to grow hops, which just weren't grown for nearly a century, except maybe as a hobby. And suddenly there's all this demand for locally grown hops, locally grown barley. So it's having a ripple effect, not just in, you know, people putting money in brewers' pockets, but it's also having an economic effect on farms and other elements of the supply chain.
Your book gave me an idea, Tim. I was aware that the Yellow Springs Brewing Company is one of the most thriving micros in the region, and your book gave me the inspiration to think, well, maybe somebody from the Yellow Springs Brewery could go along the bike path and harvest some of these wild hops, and they could make a special beer out of those wild hops.
I think it would be fascinating to do that and see what kind of a beer you got out of it. This was something someone else pointed out to me that I wasn't aware of, but if you bicycle along the Little Miami Bike Trail, especially between Xenia and Yellow Springs, and if you look carefully along the sides late in the summer, you'll see all these hop vines with these little pine cone-shaped hops flowers growing on them. And as best I can tell, these are descendants of hops that were grown on local farms or were being shipped into the local area on train cars. And as they came along the railroad, that was the Little Miami Railroad before it was a bike trail, some of these hop flowers would fly off the cars, and apparently some of them were able to take root and grow. So there's enough out there that I think that you could make at least a small batch.
And can you imagine how tasty that would be, Tim? And then they would invite you and me and Peter over to try it?
Oh, I know. I would have to try it just out of...
Because it was our idea.
Right. Well, just out of, you know.
Now, if you're out there listening right now and you're going in the Yellow Springs Brewery, make sure you mention to them that we were talking about this project. Okay? It's really important.
I'll go out and help them pick some.
There we go. We have a volunteer for all these volunteer hops.
That's right.
Right? Okay.
No, I do. I think that would actually be a fascinating project, and I'd be interested in following up on that if somebody takes it on.
Okay. All right, your next event is Thursday, August 15th at 5:30 p.m. You'll be at the Barrel House in Dayton. Now, I'm not familiar with this this brewery. This is a brewery, right?
This is not a brewery. Okay. This is a tap house.
Okay.
But what they have is they have craft beers from all over the region.
Oh.
So it's a great place to go sample craft beers, not just from around Dayton, but from all over. So it's... They're they've been very enthusiastic about this project and they're I guess they're not brewers themselves, but they're cheerleaders for the brewers.
That reminds me, I'm involved in beer myself in a retail fashion. I won't mention how, but I have a customer who brought me a little sign one time, and it says "Free beer tomorrow," and I've always liked that sign a lot. History and a Pint. Okay, your next event is at Star City Brewing in Miamisburg, and this is kind of a hometown thing. This is Friday, August 23rd at 5:30 p.m. Star City is at 320 South 2nd Street in Miamisburg, and this is kind of like your local, isn't it?
It is literally the closest brewery to where I live. It's about a five-minute walk if I take my time, and there's no train coming down the tracks. Got a special place, I guess, in my heart, because before it was Star City Brewing, it was the Peerless Mill Restaurant, and that was where my wife and I had our wedding reception back in 1977.
Wow!
But it's a wonderful little place, though. The bar, it's a big building. There's all kinds of rooms in there, but the bar area is small. It's got these hewn wood beams, stone floor. Hmm. It's just a very nice rustic place. And it was originally a sawmill built right along the canal in 1826.
That is one of the cool things about these facilities is a lot of them are retrofitting and fixing up old locations. And is it Lock 27 that's in the old Delco operation building of some kind?
That's right, yeah.
Okay.
It opens out onto 5th, 3rd Field there. And one of the cool things about that is when you go in there at the bar, they have all these taps. And the taps are built into old welding tanks. And it's just neat. It's just a way of carrying that industrial ambiance, I guess.
Another one that is in a cool space is Mother Stewart's in Springfield. And tell us who Mother Stewart was.
Mother Stewart was, in her time, she was internationally known as a temperance leader. And she was involved in that temperance crusade that I mentioned that was in the 1870s. And she lived in Springfield, and she actually is buried there in the Springfield Cemetery. So when the brewery was formed, they were looking for a name that would somehow represent the local history, and they came up with Mother Stewart, which is ironic being, you know, a name for a brewery.
I think it's a great idea. I think it's a tribute to Mother Stewart. I'm sure she's very proud wherever she is.
I'm certainly I don't know if she would be proud, but I do think that what it has done is it's made more people aware of her than were before. You know, it's gotten her story back out.
I've had their beer. It's good.
It is.
They actually can it. I mean, you don't see it very often, but I've seen it in cans. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm not a beer connoisseur. I have a fairly narrow palate. But from what I've seen, the beer here in our breweries can stand up to any beer in the country.
Okay, you've opened the door. What's your beer? What kind of beer do you like?
Well, again, I'm not a connoisseur, so I tend to like IPAs and pale ales more during the winter, but during the summer and on really hot days like this when it's getting up into the 90s, I'll go for a lighter pale ale or a lager or even a pilsner. So
I think when it's hot like it is today, that a very refreshing beer is a nice cold German wheat beer.
I think that's
very refreshing. And then when you get into the winter months, the darker days, you go with the darker stuff, the porters, the stouts, the ambers.
Yeah. See, now that's where you leave me behind. I'm not proud of the fact, but a lot of those beers, which are fine beers, that I just don't have the palate to appreciate them. And so I tend to just stick with the IPAs and pale ales.
Well, I think after you do your history in a pint tour, you might have a little more developed palate, Tim. I think it's very possible that after you've been at Warped Wing and the Barrel House and Star City Brewing and Eudora Brewing and Lock 27 and Carillon and Moeller and Mother Stewart's, I think you'll probably have a very well-developed palate.
That could be. Well,
okay. Bottles or cans?
Tap.
Tap? Do you have a tap in your house?
I don't.
You just walk around the corner.
But I do think the best way to appreciate craft beer is to get it from the tap.
All right.
Personally, though, if I'm getting it to go, I prefer cans just because they're more recyclable. I just think they have a little less impact on the environment.
Well, they're really going to cans. Have you noticed that? I mean,
everybody's
doing cans these days.
And I think that must have to do with the production method, that it must, I guess, easier or more economical to can than to bottle.
Well, they're lighter.
Yeah.
And when you're at the ball game and you try to throw the empty can at Pete Rose in the outfield, it won't get there. You know, the bottle, you could probably hit him. But
good point.
Yeah,
good point.
Right. We had Pete Rose on the program recently, and he was talking about the time he nearly got hit by a whiskey bottle at Shea Stadium. It was quite an anecdote. Said, hey, they threw a whiskey bottle at me. He even knew the brand. I think it was Jack Daniels.
Was it full or empty? That's
I think it was empty,
question.
But, you know, you get a little glass bottle, you can heave those pretty far.
So if it was full, it might have been a gift. But
I think it was empty, and I think that might be one of the reasons it was thrown.
It might be one of the reasons why he resented it.
And they threw all kinds of stuff at him. He didn't talk about beer, though. And that's what we're talking about today. The book is Dayton Beer, A History of Brewing in the Miami Valley. Tim Gaffney wrote it. And I got to tell you, the Yellow Springs Brewery Boat Show IPA, it's blowing up around here. I know, and this isn't just anecdotal, the Bell's Brewery out of Michigan used to really have a big market share here in this area. Their Two-Hearted Ale was a big selling IPA. And after they started putting out the Boat Show IPA and selling it in cans, it just blew the Bells away. I mean, it's just unbelievable.
There's a lot of opinions out there about beers, but that's one of my go-to beers, both that one and Two-Hearted Ale. Of course, I'm a Hemingway fan, so I liked it for that reason, if nothing else. But
And you talk about in your book how the Yellow Springs Brewery started up and had no idea, and suddenly they ran out of beer.
They almost put themselves out of business. Well, they did put themselves out of business.
They couldn't keep up with demand. That's amazing.
They had to shut down and make more beer.
That's a great story. Well, they're doing a great job over there. And there's a rumor there's another brewery opening in Yellow Springs. And this is going to be more like the good old days, a town of 4,000 people that could support two breweries.
You know, I'm losing track of all the breweries that are opening. One of the most fascinating ones to me is the Moeller Brew Barn. It's in Maria Stein up in Mercer County. That's in what they call the land of the cross-tipped churches. But it's really, you know, it's about as rural as you can get out there. And they are selling beer all over this part of the state and maybe farther at this point.
I haven't seen their beer.
They
It's called Moeller?
Well, Moeller is the company, but they make a whole series of beers that they're canning. One of my favorites is the Honey Wagon IPA.
Honey Wagon, huh?
Honey Wagon IPA.
That's hilarious.
But it's just this, they started out as this little brewery that was built to look like a barn. And the brewer, Nick Moeller, was a former, he was a submarine engineer. He worked on nuclear submarines out in California.
Oh.
And he and his wife decided to come back to Maria Stein and raise their children there. And he said that was, he had gotten into home brewing and he decided to build a brewery because he said, what am I going to do? There's no submarines in Maria Stein.
Huh. Well, as we are recording this, it is July 19th, and tomorrow is the 50th anniversary of the moon landing. Are you doing anything special for that?
Probably having a beer.
Are you? Good. Well, after you go, we're going to work on a special little thing we're going to put on the air tomorrow morning, which people will have already heard, but we're going to go back to my 1996 interview with Buzz Aldrin, and I've already brought in a bribe for my sound man, so we can work on that. Everybody's admiring that. It's a bottle of beer, folks. And we have these two little shot glasses that have probably never had alcohol in them. The one that says, the saloons must go, and the other one that says, goodbye, Mr. Booze. And we could probably pour some shots of this delicious beer into these shot glasses if we really wanted to, huh? But we won't do that. You're not saying anything, Tim. You look jealous, though.
Well, one of the things I was going to mention was that in all the celebrations at the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11, one of the ways that the country is celebrating is with all these commemorative craft beers that have taken some kind of a moon theme or a space theme. So, again, the Moeller Brew Barn came out with a special brew for Wapakoneta. They're the closest brewery to Wapakoneta.
Uh-huh. Neil Armstrong's hometown.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Wapakoneta has been celebrating with the theme First on the Moon. So now you can go into stores. You can even down around here in the Dayton area, you can find a pale ale called First on the Moon Pale Ale that Moeller Brew Barn made for this occasion.
Oh, wow. I have not seen that. First on the Moon by Moeller Brewing out of Maria Stein.
Right.
Oh, I have to look for that one. Well, I'm excited about the 50th anniversary of the moon landing. And you heard my interview recently that we brought back with the late Neil Loving. And I understand that you met him.
I got to meet him once at the Dayton Air Show. I believe it was at the 1992 Air Show. He was a remarkable guy. I didn't get a chance to talk to him very much. I know him mainly by what I've read about him. But he was just an indomitable person. He faced all kinds of challenges. He was an African-American, so he faced discrimination. He was severely injured in an airplane crash and lost both legs, as I recall.
Uh-huh.
And he persevered through all that, built his own, designed and built his own airplane, had a career at Wright-Patterson. Listening to him on your interview, he sounded like the nicest, most relaxed person you could ever meet.
Totally positive. Well, we really appreciate your time today, Tim.
I'm grateful for the opportunity to be here.
My guest has been Tim Gaffney. His book is Dayton Beer, A History of Brewing in the Miami Valley. For the Book Nook, it's Bottoms Up.